time. Welcome you here today. Excuse me, we're in the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee of Ways and Means, going to be considering House Bill 5026 for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and our Legislative Fiscal Office, represented by Susie Jordan. Linda Schar is our clerk for the day, and Vanessa is our honored guest here at the dais as well. We welcome you, and we have with us today the Director of Bureau of Labor and Industry for the State of Oregon, Jack Roberts. Welcome, Director Roberts. Would you like to come forward and present all the good things? I mentioned to Representative Patridge two things. I said one of them was political, so I'll have to say it off the record, kind of. But I said Director Roberts is never a man that asks for two loaves when he needs one, and Director Roberts is a man that I'd like to see him in our next budget hearing in a different executive capacity.
Should I go ahead and just make my contribution? Thank you, Chair Butler and member of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm going to give you a general overview of our agency, what we do, and the budget, and then later we'll go into more detail about the budget parts of that. Given who's in attendance today, it's a little easier because both of you were on this committee last year, or last session, when we went over this. And what I can tell you is that we're continuing on the same path that we have before. I think there are some good things that are happening with our agency, but I have to tell you that at some point it becomes very difficult for us to continue to meet the requests for continued budget cuts, because contrary to some popular belief, you cannot keep cutting forever without affecting what you do as an agency. When I was elected in 1994 and came into this office, it was an agency that believed itself to be under siege and felt that they had had devastating cuts and reductions. They didn't have the resources to do the job. We were able to come in and look at how we could reorganize and restructure and refocus what we were doing, and I believe improve our performance in all of our core functions by eliminating some of the things that were not really closely related to what we did, such as licensing TV and radio repair, licensing court reporters, licensing private employment agencies, and to refocus on our core missions and do a better job, even with less staff and with fewer resources. I think we're reaching the point now where this budget that's recommended by the governor, if we adopt it, will impact our service delivery system. It will not devastate it. And when you compare our cuts and reductions and what it will do to the reductions that I know are being proposed in the state police, in higher education, in senior services, I'm not here to argue that you should put us back in and find their money someplace else. But I don't want to kid anyone into thinking that we can continue to absorb these kinds of cuts without it having an impact. Let me talk a little bit about where we've gone and what we're doing. And as I think you remember, there are three basic things that we do. We enforce civil rights laws, we enforce wage and hour laws, and we oversee apprenticeship programs that are primarily, although not exclusively, in the construction trades. We also, within that whole area, we provide technical assistance to employers to help them comply with those laws, and also in the process give them some other information that we think is helpful to them in terms of managing, particularly in human resources and the like. And I would tell you that I continue to get high marks from people for our ability to do that, both in terms of the seminars that we put on, the publications we put out, and also ability to respond to questions that we receive. So we take that very seriously. We think that's a very important part of what we do. But in terms of our enforcement activity, we also work hard to try to make sure that we provide rapid response and handle our caseload effectively. So let me talk a little bit about each of those areas. In civil rights, this was an area where when we came in, everyone said we're just swamped with our workload. In fact, the first issue that was confronted us was whether we should redistribute cases from our Portland office to our field offices because of the backlog. And I was told that by some of our management people, they'd like to do that even though they knew it would result in an employee grievance, because the last time we had done that, we had promised we'd never do that again, and that it wasn't fair to the other areas that were up to speed to do that. I said, we have to stop trying to deal with this in a crisis mode, figure out a way to handle these cases more expeditiously. By Oregon law, when we have a complaint filed, we have 1 year to decide whether to go forward with it or not. And I think that's a good law, and it holds our feet to the fire. But when we came in, we were averaging 11 and a half months to resolve our cases. We set as a goal trying to resolve those cases, deciding whether to go forward to a full contested case hearing or dismiss them within 180 days. We're averaging 160 days, so we're meeting that goal. The primary task that we used to do that was to evaluate the cases early on the basis of early interviews with the complainant and with the respondent, the business or employer that the complaint was filed against. And what we were trying to do was to get an interview and a response for every complainant within 30 to 45 days. Our goal is, at some point, we'd like to do it all within 30 days. But we said initially we'd do it within 30 to 45 days. We are averaging 40 days to get most of these interviews taking place and getting a response back from the employer. An initial assessment of that has allowed us to dismiss those cases that don't have merit or that we don't believe are provable. One of the things that we have found, not only in reviewing our own work, but around the country, is the vast majority of civil rights cases are dismissed, either because the complaint, while it may represent unfair or what we might regard as bad management practices, often don't result in discrimination as defined by law. As I think you know, there's no law against being an equal opportunity jerk if you're an employer. You just can't discriminate against people and be a jerk to some and not to others based on certain criteria. And so when we explain that to people and let them get on with their lives, that's a way of dismissing the cases and reducing our caseload. At the same time, there's some cases where it's one person's word against another, and it's pretty clear there's never going to be any evidence. And whereas before we used to spend a lot of time with people trying to encourage them to come up with more and find that, now we really try to get people to focus in on what it takes to prove a case. So we are dismissing a lot of cases now earlier. And while our staff initially had some concern about that, in fact, I remember one of the conversations I had, is it okay if we tell people by letter that they don't have a good case? We don't want to tell them face to face. I said, just tell them and get it done with. But what they found is that when they tell people early, they appreciate it. Because often they will come to us because they don't know if they have a case. They want us to tell them. What was happening before is we were dragging them on for 6 to 9 or 11 months, then telling them they didn't have a case, and yes, they were feeling abused by the process, and justifiably so. So that, I think, has been a positive thing. It's also helped us up front to take a better look at the cases when they come in the door and really decide whether people should even be filing cases with us based on what they tell us. And partly as a result of that, and partly as a result of the better economy, so there are fewer people that are leaving work and leaving their employment, our caseload in civil rights has been going down. We've had fewer cases filed. But we also have had some vacancies in positions that we've held open. We've had, because of reduction in caseload, fewer reimbursements from the EEOC, which we contract with to handle these cases so we can investigate them jointly. And so consequently, we continue to have a struggle in terms of handling our caseload, but we've tried to manage that well. There are some cuts that are proposed in this budget that will have some impact on that. As I say, they aren't cuts that I would necessarily recommend, but we're willing to accept and absorb and to deal with. Wage and hour is more of a hodgepodge of different things. And there are two areas in this that are funds that are separate funds that inflate our total funds figure and make it appear that we're not having the level of reductions that we really have. The large one in that regard is the Wage Security Fund. This is a fund that was established more than 10 years ago that is a diversion of some funds from the Employment Department, the unemployment rates, employment insurance, that's held so that if a business goes out of business or goes bankrupt and can't pay, we pay the workers and then we pursue collection. There's a limit on how much you can pay. We just increased that last session, but it's proven to be a very valuable and successful program. In fact, when it was initially adopted about 14 years ago, the legislature said, let's give it a try, and they put it on a sunset for the next session. It remained on a one session by session extension for 10 years. And finally, based on that work experience, the legislature agreed 2 sessions ago to remove the sunset, make it permanent, and also to remove the limitation on the amount. It used to be that there was a certain amount we could spend. Now, if the money's there, we can spend it. If we run out of money, we can't. This is now a healthy fund balance, and what's budgeted now is the estimated revenues we expect to get. It's about twice what we normally would be paying out, and so the funds here look like an increase in what we're spending, But unless there is the recession that some are fearing or other major layoffs, we wouldn't expect that to be all expended. At some point, this is something that I think we as a state can review whether the fund is healthy enough or not. If we always knew the economy is going to continue as it is, I'd say we're collecting more money than we need. Although it's 0.3% of the collections, one quarter out of eight, so it would not result in any significant reduction in unemployment insurance rates anyway. But I'm reluctant to mess with that until we've gone through this with a recession and the resulting reduction in revenue and the increase in claims. So I think that it's not broken and we don't need to fix it. But I want to identify that as one source of inflating the numbers somewhat that we have here in our budget that are not available for our regular operations. The other one, which is a smaller fund, but also one that I think has been very successful, it's the Prevailing Wage Rate Fund. And this is a fund that came out of our Prevailing Wage Rate System reform in 1995 when we agreed that we should be doing surveys to determine what the real prevailing wage rate is in different regions around the state, that we should beef up our enforcement and get better information out. This was part of a labor management cooperation that came through. It was unanimously passed by both houses of the legislature. We have used that fund to do surveys every year since then. We have, I think, a system that much more accurately reflects what the prevailing wage rates are. And we've also beefed up our enforcement and have been doing a better job in outreach and educating, particularly the agencies, about when this applies. But we still have a healthy fund balance. And because we receive the money based on a fee that's paid by contractors when they enter into a prevailing wage rate contract, a public contract, they pay a fee that's 0.1% of the value of the contract, not less than $100, not more than $5,000. Again, the amount that we're receiving is more than we're spending, but we haven't been through a recession or a down cycle, so this is another one that I wouldn't necessarily recommend making changes in at the time, but it does show a fund balance that appears on our budget that's healthy, but it's not available for other operations. We have, over time, put more of our prevailing wage rate functions in enforcement in that fund, and that's helped our general fund, and we think that's been prudent management. The wage in our division, otherwise, we've seen wage claims, particularly if you look at the wage security fund, they've gone up and down. It has not had the kind of steady decline that we've seen in civil rights, but we have seen some movement in that. I think that this is, again, an area where we have become more efficient and more effective, but the continued cuts would be difficult. Apprenticeship is an area where we've actually made some significant cuts because we've changed some of the focus of what we do. I had just come into office a short time before when I received a call from someone from Associated General Contractors. I almost flipped up and said AGC, but it was Associated General Contractors. And they called me and said, we've been talking to some of our members who say they're going to quit our apprenticeship programs and set up their own, because if we do that, the Bureau of Labor and Industries will run it for us rather than us having to pay to have it run. Is that right? And I said, well, I'm just new here. I can't tell you if that's true, but I can guarantee you that's not right, and we shouldn't be doing that. And I checked, and sure enough, that's what we'd started doing in the 1980s to try to encourage more apprenticeship programs, and the time when coming out of the recession of the early 80s, people were having trouble getting work anyway, and they were getting reluctant. So we were agreeing to set up and run these ostensibly as a startup. But like a lot of things, as long as we were willing to do it, they never really got around to assuming that responsibility. So we decided to change. And the other problem that created for us was that we were running the programs, and then we were supposed to be doing the enforcement to ensure they were complying with all the rules and that people were getting real training. And when I went to an apprenticeship graduation ceremony and had a person come up to me and say, you know, I graduated from the program a year ago, and I never did X, Y, and Z, and they said to me I didn't have to do it. And I said, well, did you talk to our office? And said, it was your office person who told me I didn't have to do it. She's no longer with us, by the way. But I said, this isn't right. We ought to be there. We ought to help people, encourage people, but we ought to be there to have some accountability. They ought to be running their own programs, and they ought to have the investment and the commitment, because if a contractor isn't committed to run the program, they're probably not committed to really making it successful. And that in many cases, some people are only doing that so that they could bid on prevailing wage rate projects using the apprenticeship at the below journeyman rate. And so consequently, we redirected this, changed it to a more privatized system, and got help. The legislature passed a bill which allowed us to exempt these committees from some of the normal, well, actually got to treat them as not government committees or public committees, so they didn't have to comply with all the public meetings and public records laws, and said, we're here to help you, but we're not here to run your committees for it. So we were able to cut our staffing, cut that, but actually have improved what we've done in apprenticeship. Now, partly as a result of that, and partly as a result of some things that have happened in the economy outside the Portland metropolitan area, our apprenticeship programs, which were growing by leaps and bounds for several years after we got here, and went from having a little over 6,000 registered apprentices to a high of over 9,000 registered apprentices, we've now dropped back and we're now down around 7,000. But I am convinced that the fewer number of apprentices masks what really has happened. That is that we have more real, honest, legitimate apprenticeship programs, and that the apprentices we have are actually getting the training they need to have to become journey workers when they leave, and if it's in a licensed trade, to be able to get their license. Our dropout rate in many of these has been reduced, and I think that our apprenticeship programs today overall are doing a much better job than they did when we came in. And in talking to the folks in the building trades, they feel that way too. It hasn't been entirely without controversy, and one of the areas that has had the greatest controversy has been our adoption of new standards for the selection methods for apprentices. And it's possible that some of you may have heard from people in your districts that we now have required that they use more objective standards for admissions and eliminated a system that had been used before. It was called Selection Method D, which said you could go out and basically we'd pre-approve a whole bunch of people for apprentices, but they had to come out and find their own job with you. And a study by in the Portland metropolitan area by City of Portland, Multnomah County, and TriMet established that system does tend to have a discriminatory effect for women and minorities. It had been ruled unlawful by a federal court in California. The state of Washington had dropped it some years before. And so we forced everyone to drop that method and go to one of several more objective selection methods that would prevent possible discrimination or even unintentional discrimination based on job hiring practices of the individual contractors. By and large, that has worked well. And in many of the trades, we have actually seen an increase in the number of women and minorities, not in all of them. And in those where it's not, we're trying to go back and figure out why that's happened, what's going on. But our approach is not to try to meet some arbitrary standard of what we think ought to be the composition of the workforce, because particularly in Oregon, that varies on a regional basis in the composition of the workforce and on the other opportunities that are available to women and minorities in those opportunities. What we want to make sure is that we have a non-discriminatory objective selection method for every committee in the state. That's our goal. We think we're generally achieving that now, and we want to continue to work on that. I feel that our apprenticeship programs today as a whole, and our apprenticeship council, which is appointed by the governor, but we have the best apprenticeship council in memory of anyone that I've talked to. They're committed to making the apprenticeship work, and we think, and we've tried to respond to the problems that have come up. And I remember, Senator Yee, we had the issue that came up before with limited energy technicians, and you asked that we accommodate some concerns, and we tried to do that. I think that we're doing a good job in apprenticeship. We are doing it with fewer people because we've changed the focus of what we're doing. And finally, technical assistance. I'll touch on that and then be glad to take any questions that you have. Technical assistance is an area, as I say, that we continue to get high marks. We have tried from time to time to make that fully self-funding. That is, to make enough from our seminars, from our publications, and from those paid programs that we offer to employers to do that, cover all the costs of that, plus cover the cost of our free telephone call-in service, which we think is critical to maintain. That has not generally been possible because of the nature of what we do, and we have been able to come up with other revenues to cover that. I do think that what we do in technical assistance is very important, but we are not losing sight of our objective to try to make sure that when we provide things that are of benefit to businesses primarily, that they pay for them. And I think that is continues to be our goal, but we are not going to allow that budgetary constraint to get in the way of one of the most essential things we do, which is to respond free of charge to people's questions, because we would far more like to involve ourselves up front in avoiding problems that come in later on the enforcement side. Compliance is our goal, and that's what the technical assistance team helps us to achieve. And so based on that, we've put together this budget. I would stress that it is put together at the request of the governor to meet certain numerical targets. We have made a 10% reduction in our budget. The first 5%, roughly, are cuts that we believe are manageable. They're not necessarily ideal because as we do these, we can manage them, but we're running pretty thin. The second 5% are cuts that we would rather not make, that we think those are going to impact service delivery. But again, given what you're looking at the rest of your budget and with the other demands, I'm not here asking you to restore those. I just want you to understand. One final thing I will mention also, and I believe that the co-chairs of Ways and Means have looked at this and have signed off on it, and that is a shift of funding for four of our civil rights investigators from the Workers' Compensation Fund back to the general fund. When we came in, all these positions were funded out of the general fund. The largest area of enforcement that we have in terms of total number of cases are complaints about retaliation due to workers' comp complaints, people who have filed complaints and either have been terminated as a result of that, can't be hired elsewhere, and this is a part of our law of what we enforce. The idea was proposed to us when we came in, and we agreed to it, of having a portion of our civil rights investigators that was proportionate to that portion of the caseload have that paid out of the workers' comp fund. We felt that was reasonable because the non-discrimination is an integral part of the overall workers' comp system. And just as we're trying to get people back to work and get them off of workers' comp when they're able to work, we also want to make sure they're not discriminated against when they do that. So that was the basis for that move. It has been controversial and has been resisted several years. And finally this year, the governor, at the request of some members of the legislature, agreed to shift it back to the general fund. I think it presented to you as an ad package. It's not an ad. It's just a shift to put what had been moved into the workers' comp fund back into the general fund. We support that, but we want to make sure that no one thinks that we're adding anything new or we're doing anything different. This is simply a fund shift. It's not a shift in how we do our business.
Commissioner Roberts, can you tell us where that's at in relationship to the budget package? Come on in, folks. There's lots of room somewhere in the room. They heard you were coming today, Commissioner Roberts. They wanted to meet one of the leading, one of the top elected officials in the state. So, folks, this is Labor Commissioner Jack Roberts, one of the highest elected officials in the state of Oregon. He's here today presenting his budget. Commissioner Roberts' budget has been severely cut under the arrangement which we have with the reduced revenues in the state of Oregon, and he's limping badly, but he's able to he's still able to tread water.
And Mr. Chairman, in anticipating them coming here, I held off talking about our child labor. Let me just say briefly, one of the things that we do enforce are the child labor laws, which have to do with any minor who goes in the workplace.
Commissioner Roberts, would you feel more comfortable turning around and addressing? You're certainly welcome to do that.
That's okay.
You bet. Please.
Never pass up an audience, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
What? Those of you, I don't know how many of you have had jobs yet and have gone workforce, but one of the things that I faced when I came into this office was that a lot of people weren't very eager to hire minors because of the paperwork that was involved. It used to be that if you wanted to go get a job and you were a minor, first you had to come down to our office and get a work permit, and you had to have that and show that you were old enough to work and had limitations and had that done. We decided that wasn't really necessary. That was busy paperwork for us, so we got that eliminated. Went to the legislature, got that eliminated. But it also used to be that each employer, if you went there to work, had to have a separate work certificate with your name on it and your restrictions and all that. That was also an awful lot of paperwork. And I remember back when I was a kid and was going to work, they didn't used to require that. If you wanted to hire minors, you had to file one time with the state, and they'd say, yes, you've got a good clean record, you can hire minors, and gave you some indication of what the rules are about the hours you can work. And some of you may have run into that already, that if you're 14 or 15, you can do certain things. You can do a little more if you're 16 or 17. And of course, once you're 18, then you're an adult. And so protecting you from things that might be harmful to you or dangerous to you, they'd set those up. And we're the ones who enforce that. And if that's an option, you're not sure about that, we're the people to ask. But we wanted to get rid of the extra paperwork because my view is that while your school is the most important thing to you, a work experience is also important. And that the purpose of our jobs is to make sure that on the job you're not endangered and you're not exploited, but it's not there to make sure you can't be employed. We think that having a job, a good job, can be a good experience. So we tried to make the law easier to comply with. And I think as a result of the changes, we have done that. And hopefully, if you've had an experience before, it's been a good one. And if you go into the workforce later and have the chance to do some work, again, putting your schoolwork first and having other things to do with your time, that you'll have a chance to get the work experience you need in an environment that's safe and is positive for you. And so that's one of the things that we do as an agency. Any of you have questions? Is it okay if I
Yes, I was going to ask. If any of you have questions, and Representative Vanessa Schar, if you have any questions, and the youngest member of the legislature.
For most of your... I think babysitting and mowing lawns really fine. If you're doing that just on a casual basis, now if you suddenly start doing that 40 hours a week, that becomes a job. Most things you cannot do, not only by our rules, but by federal law under the age of 14. There are a few exceptions, but by and large, you have to be 14. 14 and 15, there are limitations both in terms of the hours you can work, and especially during the school years, we don't like to see you working too many hours, so we have some limits on that. We also have very strong limits on what kind of equipment you can use, because most of the safety hazards are using heavy equipment or motorized equipment, and generally 14 and 15 you can't. We have some exceptions for that in agriculture. If you take some tests and prove your proficiency, you can do that safely. So we have some limitations on that. Then at 16 and 17, a lot of those are removed, not entirely. Once you turn 18, you're no longer a minor. At the age of 18, you can pretty much do anything any other adult can do. Yes? You can work in a retail store if you can be stocking shelves, and that you can't use mechanical forklifts or loaders or those things. Again, in agriculture, there are some exceptions for how that, but you can get those kinds of jobs. You can work as a clerk in the store. You can run errands. You can do some of those jobs. The main thing you can't do are things on foot. Yeah, you can't. Yeah. Actually, at 14, we discourage you from driving a car under any circumstances. But actually, even at 16 and 17, you generally can't have a job that requires you to drive a car. Because the concern is that in those kind of, the old stories used to be the pizza deliveries where they'd say, we'll get your pizza to you in 30 minutes or else you'll get it for free. And so you put these kids in cars and say, hurry up, you got to get there in 5 minutes. That's a recipe for disaster. So we don't allow most of that. Yes? Yes, most of the rules that we have don't apply if you're working for your parents. Now, again, there are some exceptions there if you and your parents are working. We had this recently in the case of a custodial job where they went clean some office buildings, and there's some hours restrictions that, particularly school days, you can't be working past, I think it's 7 o'clock. We have some provisions. We have a wage and hour commission, which is appointed by the governor, that actually makes all these rules for child labor. And they have some ability to waive some of that in the case of families. We have a much broader range of things you can do with your family. And the idea is that your parents are there to look out for you and take care of you. If you're working for somebody else, then we have much more strict rules. Anybody else? Well, thanks for coming by. And if you have other questions, our office, we have an office in Portland, in Salem, in Eugene, in Medford. As of today, we have one in Bend. Depending on what these guys do, we may or may not have one in the future. But feel free to call, or if you have questions, or you can write us a letter. We'll be glad to answer. Thanks.
Thank you very much for having
us. Yes, Representative Johnson's recognized.
Before you leave, where are all of you students from?
I'm sorry, I'm out of middle school.
Great, good for you. Thank
Welcome.
You.
It's nice to have you. Thank you very much.
That's just stalling, so I can ask you a question.
He did an excellent job of stalling. Page 27. 97.
Injured worker fund show.
301.
Yes.
And that's the one that would, that is already in, it's not, looks like it nets to zero. Is that what I'm reading?
That's correct, because it reduces that from the other funds and adds it to the general fund.
Okay, all right.
It's a net zero effect on total funds, but it does put more into the general fund.
And specifically, again, Commissioner Roberts, that package for the injured workers benefit fund, what is that what it was? I beg your pardon.
Chairman, the way that originally worked is that those when I first came in here, those were already positions were already being funded out of the general fund. And at that time, the idea to try to free up general fund was to move it into the workers' comp fund. And initially, it went through with no problem. Subsequently, some of the members of MLAC, the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which is an acronym, that group said, we really don't like this. We don't like this in principle. We think it's wrong. I will tell you honestly, I think it's a reasonable amount to be paid out of the workers' compensation system, because I think the non-discrimination rules are a part of the overall system. And in fact, when we reformed workers' comp in 1990, part of what we did was stiffen the rules for discrimination, because the whole purpose was to get people back to work. But that has been a bone of contention for many people in the legislature every year since then. And the governor agreed to move it back to the general fund, and we have no problem with it.
How has it been collected as an assessment against the workers' compensation? Do each of the compensation carriers collect it and pay it?
No, it's just a small diversion from what I think is. It started out being out of one fund, then I have another, and I'm not an expert in workers' comp, so I can't tell you all the reasons. But I think it's now out of the one that's the joint labor and the employer employee pay into a fund for a joint benefit fund. It's got millions and millions and millions of dollars. This is a drop in the bucket, but it's maybe more accurately called a burr under the saddle of some people that's been an annoyance to them. It did not affect workers' compensation rates one penny.
Mm-hmm.
And if we put it back in there, it will be not even noticed.
Is this part of the surcharge that's covered, that's tacked on to policies?
Mr. Chair, it's a cents per hour.
Cents per hour
on wages.
The one that we used to call a secondary or tertiary injury fund.
I don't know what you called it then. It's in the olden days. Yeah, I don't know.
We had the wheelbarrow.
It's called the Workers' Benefit Fund now.
Okay.
It used to be the Injured Worker Fund, and they used it for various benefits in the workers' compensation system. In 1995 is when the Bureau of Labor proposed using that money. It takes specific legislation to transfer the money out of that fund to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. In the last legislative session, the agency was directed by budget note to build their budget without the use of these injured worker funds.
And does the statutory authority to remove this or to move this from the injured workers fund, does it automatically cease then at the end of this biennium?
That's correct.
Okay, yes. All right. So in order to modify this package and move it back into other funds from general funds, we would need legislative authority to do so. Has there been any you're following the law and the letter of the intent of the original budget note?
Chairman, that's exactly right. And I've mentioned to one of the co-chairs of Ways and Means that as you get towards the end of the session, if you find you're $500,000 short somewhere, this is some place to look. But it's no skin off our nose one way or the other. It is important that we continue to have this. Paying it out of the general fund is fine with us. And I just sort of step back and look at it from a broader policy perspective, and it seems to me that you can certainly justify what we've done the last several years, but I know there are others who disagree with me about that, and they have votes here and I don't. So as far as I'm concerned, this package is fine as it is.
Commissioner Roberts, Representative Johnson has a train arrangement that she's trying to get a train to go into her district, a little further into her district, and it's going to cost $531,000 to get that into her district, but it's going to have to be general fund, so maybe she would...
Say goodbye, Jack.
she would be so kind as to go ahead and drop the bill to make sure that injured workers fund just gets moved back around to generate $500,000 or $531,000 back in the general fund.
That would, Mr. Chairman, that'd be fine with us, but I think Representative Johnson's the one who's got to tell Senator Dorfler, I'm not.
Okay, thank you very much. If you'd like to, first of all, are there any questions to this particular point for Commissioner Roberts? I keep going to Director Roberts, I beg your pardon. Please, Representative Johnson's recognized.
Thank you. Forgive this question. This is reflective of my freshman status and my newness to the Ways and Means process. For a long time, you have talked about the necessity of even having this bureau, and I believe that there may be, again, legislation making its way through the building speaking about the existence of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Could you speak to that issue at all? I mean, obviously, you have to have a budget to continue to operate, but in what way has that discussion reflected the budget document that you're bringing forward for consideration?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Johnson, this budget document does not reflect that, because my impression is, while we did drop a bill this time, that it is not moving through the building. It is sort of sitting where it is and where it's going to be when it dies. But I'll give you my thoughts on this anyway, because it is a subject which I continue to talk, and so far have few who are willing to act on it. But my sense, having been here now for 6 years, and when I came in here, I said I wanted to look at this issue. I had not made my mind up. After having looked at it, I am convinced more than ever that our agency is, frankly, too small and too isolated from other related functions to operate as efficiently as it should. And one of the things that happens to us is that as we cut, part of our basic infrastructure of running an agency can only be cut so far. You need somebody to do your payroll and your labor relations. You need somebody to do information systems. You need somebody to do fiscal. You need people to do these things. And our agency ends up, as it shrinks, becoming top-heavy administratively. We also have the problem in that, given our size, that when we lose a person, either because they get a better offer somewhere else, they have other opportunities, or just because of whatever reason, it's harder for us to absorb that the smaller and the tighter that we get. We also end up losing people more often because we don't have the opportunities for upward mobility, and people don't have the opportunity for advancement. And so people who have a lot of skills, a lot of ambition, and opportunities end up looking elsewhere. They don't have as much chance to grow within our agency. And so those reasons, in addition to just the fact that I think we can collaborate much better with related things like building codes, which is closely related to a lot of what we do in apprenticeship, OSHA, which is within the function of what this agency was for years, in dealing with workers' safety, even things like workers' comp, unemployment, a lot of those things would be reasonably co-located with us. The major impediment to that, in my opinion, and one that I believe is a fatal impediment to bringing those all together into current form, is putting them under an elected official. Because in my judgment, I don't think the voters typically have the information that they need to have to select an administrator, and certainly have no ability to constantly oversee that administrator the way I think you need to have to run effectively. And I'm very proud of the job that we have done, and I would say that since I've been here, I think we've done a good job, but I also know that most of the people who voted for me didn't have a clue what kind of administrator I was. A great many who voted to reelect me didn't know. And I've said before that there were people who voted for me for this job that would not have hired someone to mow their lawn knowing as little about them as they know about me. But they did that because it was an election, and for whatever, in fact, I've often felt that because my opponent had been here for a long time, a lot of people voted for me just because of my party affiliation, and some of them voted for me just because they thought it was a time for a change, regardless of that. And I think that's not the way to run an agency. And if we make this a bigger, more powerful agency, which I think would be a good way to go, I think the Department of Consumer Business Services is too big today. And if you took some of the workplace functions out of that and merged it with our agency, and Representative Gardner has a bill to do some of this, and the only reason I don't support it is because it also keeps the elected labor commissioner in there. But if you made this an appointed position and brought those things together, I think that'd be a better agency. Alternatively, what we proposed is eliminate the elected labor commissioner, just move it under the DCBS umbrella, not because I think it needs to be there long term, But I think the more things you shove under that umbrella, the sooner it will become obvious to everybody that it's too big already and needs to be broken up. Either way you do that, I think we can operate better as part of an agency that has a broader range of activities, related activities, and have more of the critical mass that would make for efficiency. I'm not one of those who believes that the size of an agency alone determines its effectiveness. I think it is possible to be too small to be efficient, and I think we are. I think it's possible to be too big to be efficient. I think DCBS may be there or getting there. But that's a call for the legislature. And my sense is today that there is neither the interest in making that kind of major reorganizational changes, nor, frankly, does there seem to be the interest in this building in eliminating another office that term-limited legislators can run for when they're out of time here. And just to be very blunt about it, I think that's a factor. All I can do is give you my best judgment, and you guys have to decide what you want to do. My impression to date has been that there is not the desire or will to go forward and make those kinds of changes. So we're doing the best we can with the situation that we've got.
Thank you very much. That was extremely helpful to me.
Thank you. Relative to the technical assistance program for employers, I just had a question regarding that. This technical assistance is provided over telephone line, pamphlets, leaflets, materials, seminars, workshops, keep business community informed about employment law and compliance issues. I'm looking on page 13 of the agency summary, and just taking a look at that under the Commissioner's Office and Program Support Services. Commissioner Roberts, you're very familiar with other branches of government. Are there things there that should be done by the Department of Employment? Are there things here that are being done by the agency that small business development centers could be doing? Help me with the overlap there of the issues. And generally, probably, can you zero in on the relationship with the Department of Employment?
Mr. Chairman, short answer is no, I don't think the things that we're doing are being done elsewhere or could be done better elsewhere, because the main focus of our effort is in helping people with those, how to comply with those laws that we enforce. And one of the things that I've worked hard on since I've been there, because there were some problems in the past, is making sure that our technical assistance people are giving the same message that our enforcement people give, so that we really are making sure that people comply and that they're not getting whipsawed between getting one interpretation from one group and another from those who ultimately do the enforcement. That's why I think we have a problem if we farm that out to someone else, is that there's a risk that they're going to tell them the law means one thing and we're going to tell them another. Frankly, we already have that now with the Department of Administrative Services and the Attorney General's Office both presuming to advise people on what prevailing wage rate law is, and then we come along as the enforcement people and say, we don't agree. We're working on that, but it continues to be a problem. In terms of our relationship with employment and with others, we have been engaging in some broader-based seminars that include, in fact, we work with the Oregon School Board Association to put on some seminars where we play a part of it and others do other things. I think that collaboration is already going on. So I don't think that there's really, in our current setup, an opportunity to cut costs or to shift that load onto someone else. I do think that what we do well. And in fact, in the last session, there was a bill passed that authorizes us to use money from our prevailing wage rate fund, not only for education about specifically prevailing wage rate, but to use it on a broader basis, educational basis, for other types of public contracting law. This was at the request of the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities and others, who said it'd be nice to have a one-stop shop. We said, you can house that with us, which is what their request was. You're going to have to cope with the program, because we're trying to meet your needs. We're not trying to build an empire. And since then, all that we've had requests for is, would you please subsidize our seminars? And we said, no, you ought to be charging enough for your seminars as we do to cover your costs. If you really think there's a place for us to play a role, give us an L and give us an example. We haven't done any of that. So it's still in the books. We still have that opportunity available to us. And I was flattered initially that they came to us thinking that we would be a good place to house that. When I found out that all they wanted was a chance to tap into our fund, I was a little less flattered and a little more skeptical, but we're continuing to have that opportunity available, and we always look for opportunities to collaborate and work together with others where possible.
Would you, the hearings unit portion of the program descriptions, are you prepared to cover that, or have you covered that in some detail already that I just, I didn't recall.
No, I didn't really talk about
it. You just touched on it, and...
No, actually, we generally try not to talk about that because we don't want to remind you that we got an exemption from the Common Hearings Panel, and we like that exemption, and we want to stay the way we are. Let me tell you how we do that and why we opted out of the Common Hearings Panel and why we like the way we do it now. Our system operates that in both civil rights and wage and hour, we have the opportunity to do administrative hearings. We don't have to go into court. That's a big advantage over the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, also known as the EEOC, but Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, that we contract with to do enforcement. They don't have the ability to have administrative hearings. They have to go to court. Consequently, they have a much higher standard before they really enforce and take those cases. It takes longer. It's more expensive. Our administrative hearing system, we believe, works well. But to do that effectively, we think we need people who have some level of expertise in our narrow area of the law. And we have that. We have two hearings officials. We've had some turnover there, but we have people who I think are effective and handle that. The way it works is that the hearings officials are under our legal policy advisor. She supervises them. They hear the case. We have case presenters who are in the agency divisions that are in the substantive enforcement, civil rights division and wage and hour division. And they bring the cases forward, argue them. The other side is entitled to an attorney, generally has one, or they can come argue the case themselves. Go forward, make the decisions. The administrative law judge makes a preliminary assessment, puts it forward a proposed order. The final order comes to me, and I have the ability to make changes in that. I have made it a consistent policy that I don't question the findings of fact by the administrative law judge.
Can we get back to that in just a moment? We have another class with us here, Commissioner Roberts. We welcome you, young ladies and gentlemen, to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today we're hearing the House Bill number, 5026, relative to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We have with us?
Yeah, that's right.
5026. She's not good with numbers. You got to.
Yeah. No, it is House Bill 5026.
It's just printed wrong here. Okay. Somebody is. And so, Director or Commissioner Roberts, we're going to give you another opportunity to speak to these our guests here today. Commissioner Roberts is one of the highest five elected officials in the state of Oregon. It's our great honor to have him presenting his budget before the commission. His budget is a little under $20 million. It actually should be about $20,600,000, but the governor has said you're going to hold it under $20 million. So Commissioner Roberts has held his budget under $20 million and has obeyed the directive of the governor. And so, Director, Commissioner Roberts, if you'd like to... Now, where is this school class from or group from? Beaverton. Let's see. That's in Oregon, isn't it? Well, we can have them. Okay. Commissioner Roberts, please, if you'd like to go ahead.
One of the reasons I want a chance to talk to you is that one of the things that we do in our agency is enforce child labor laws. Anyone who's under the age of 18 and wants to work has to comply with those rules that we enforce. Used to be, back several years ago, and some of you may have had older brothers and sisters or know people who, when you were a minor and wanted to get a job, you had to come to our office and get a work permit. And when I was a kid, I had to do that. A lot of us did that. But we finally decided that that was really an unnecessary paperwork burden that didn't really provide us with any good information that we didn't already have. And so we eliminated that a few years ago. We also simplified the paperwork for employers so that they don't have to file a separate certificate with us each time they hire a minor. Now they file one that says, we're going to hire minors, this is what they're going to do. We can review that and make sure that it's within the restrictions that we have. And so we've tried to remove some of the artificial barriers to giving kids a chance to work, while at the same time maintaining the important protections so that you don't work too many hours during the school year, you don't work at jobs that are dangerous, don't involve equipment that is dangerous. And so we tried to do that, because our policy is we want to make sure that if you can, if you have the time, take care of your schoolwork and can still find a job, we think it's important that you not be endangered, that you not be exploited, but we don't think there's anything wrong with being employed in the right setting. So we're trying to work together to make that possible. I don't know how many of you have already had jobs and been in work experience, but hopefully you found that to be a good experience for you. If not, if you have questions about whether you should be working, the number of hours you're working, or questions about whether you should be doing the kinds of things you're doing, or questions whether you're being paid properly, you can call our office. We have an office in Portland, and give us a call and ask questions, and we'll be glad to help you. Yes?
What is the age that you're
job? Well, it varies depending on what the type of job is, and depends on whether you're working for your family or someone else. The general rule is that if you're under 14, there aren't very many things it's legal to do. Most jobs you can't get till you're 14. 14 and 15, there are some things you can do, but they're more limited, particularly during the school year, and particularly you can't use most types of equipment or that. 16 and 17, there are more things you can do, still some limitations. At 18, then you can basically do anything that other adults would do, with only a couple of exceptions.
What kind of jobs would you be able to do?
Well, I'm not sure what kind of jobs you can do, but let me tell you the jobs it's legal to do. It'll be up to you to convince an employer that you can actually do them. But you can do things like you can be a runner for some things. You can't use a car, and at 14 you can't drive a car anyway, but you can't be around motorized equipment. But you can run errands for people, you can stock shelves, you can actually even do retail clerk work, things where you're not using heavy equipment and you're not working late nights, but you can do most types of service jobs that don't involve the use of equipment. You actually can do more things in agriculture if you're out on the farm. If you take some tests on some types of equipment and have some, there are actually some rules that we have on that. The bigger problem in a lot of those cases at that age is finding employers that are willing to hire kids, because a lot of them don't want to deal with the training and the other problems. But if you can find someone who's willing to hire you, the main rule is that you can't use most types of equipment, so you need to find something you can do yourself, and it has to be a job that works within the hours that are consistent with your school during the school year. In the summer, that's more open, but you still have to find jobs that don't involve heavy equipment, other types of equipment, or things that are electrical power equipment. Those are the big no-nos. Any other questions? Well, thanks for coming in today, and hope that your visit to the Capitol has been fun as well as educational.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Roberts. Representative Johnson and I weren't very attentive, so we probably should be scolded and maybe even fined just a little bit. But she was asking me what she could do, and as much as she's just a little over 14, and well, between 14 and 16.
Trying to seek meaningful employment, sir.
Meaningful employment. One of the things that they do not allow.
Being here, you mean?
One of the things they do not allow is they do not allow legislators to run heavy equipment at all. They don't want us around anything more than adding machines and calculators. What was it that the fellow said? If you stay around the sausage factory, the sausage factory and laws are about the same way. The next day you won't like either one if you see how they're made. So. In that process, we commend you young people for coming. We're gratified that you come here, and I want you to know it's a singular honor for me to have you here and to have Commissioner Roberts here. I first met Commissioner Roberts and his wife, Liz Tammy, is it? Tammy, bless your heart, a couple of years ago. Delightful people, and we got an opportunity to know each other a little bit better, and he's got a great sense of humor, and so he puts up with me, and that shows that between and his wife has got a greater sense of humor because she puts up with him. So we are happy to have you here today, Commissioner Roberts, and we were just approaching the hearings unit, and I'm wondering if we're right near the top of the hour, if maybe we could just take a brief, I beg your pardon, Commissioner Shar, did you, or Representative Shar, did you have, she's the youngest member of the legislature, Vanessa Shar. Did you have any questions for Commissioner Roberts before we take a brief break? All right, thank you very much.
What year are all of our volume?
Almost invincible. There's only one thing being greater than an eighth grader. I mean, and that's being a 12th grader and walking across and getting your diploma. And then 4 years later, walking across and getting a sheepskin at university and feeling very, very meek about the whole process, recognizing that the world that you had by the tail 8 years before or 4 years before or 8 years before, in this case of these good young folks, isn't necessarily all that you thought it was going to be, the big old world out there. We welcome back Senator Yee.
Welcome back.
Senator
I've
Yee.
I've been here all the time.
Yes. Senator Yee has been here all the time, for the record, Senator Yee has been here all the time.
Chair, you have a question. Over here.
Yes, we have a question.
Okay. That label for the chair, are you just labeling the chair, or are you like,
I just sit on all the time? Is that what you...
Well, this chair there, so are you labeling it, or is that like your spot? Are you the big head chairman or something?
Yes, he's the big head chairman.
He's a big chair.
Well, you know, the person who's the chair should be the follower of all. He who is the chiefest should be the meekest of all. So they appointed me chair because I just am heavier than anybody in the room. So nobody wanted to be sat on for me, so they can sit on me.
Like the table over here.
I'm the chairman of this particular subcommittee, and let me just say this relative to the subcommittee while we're on kind of a quick moment here. The Ways and Means process, that's the appropriations process, if you will, the monies of the state. We'll be appropriating Representative Johnson. I got a sneaky suspicion that you're changing sides next round here. Representative Johnson is a member of the full Ways and Means Committee, as is Senator Yee. And in the process, Ways and Means is unique in that it has a Senate side and it has a House side. And in that process, there's roughly, approximately, normally, about twice as many members of the House as there are senators. Senator Clarno is in district today out in Bend, Oregon. And Senator Yee is up from Albany. Representative Smith took the afternoon off to go back to his district in the Umatilla area. And I think Representative Ringo also is in district back up in Portland. Representative Patridge is up in his office for the moment. But what happens is that we will make appropriations decisions relative to a budget total of in something in excess of $34 billion by the time we're done. That's many times, that's a lot more than I make in some years. But we'll appropriate about $34 billion for a two-year cycle for the state of Oregon. That includes $14 plus billion of general funds, and the balance of that will come from other funds, including fees and the federal funds and those kinds of things. And then when we appropriate in this committee, when we make a decision in this committee, then what is unique about the appropriation or Ways and Means process is that we then move this to a full committee. And as I say, some of us are on full committee, a couple of us are on the full committee here. Not everyone sits on the full committee, but when we move this into full committee, and full committee, there's I think a total of about 20 members of the House and the Senate who will hear our explanation of what we have done with regard to Commissioner Roberts' department, the Department of Bureau of Labor and Industries. And after they hear what we have done, what we have approved, they can either agree or disagree in full committee. If they disagree, then it comes back and we rework the bill, or it might get assigned to another committee. But normally this committee takes care of certain areas of economic interest to the state relative to things such as Labor Commissioner Roberts does, including the Department of Labor. We do handle the Department of Labor as well.
You mean Employment?
Department of Employment.
Mm-hmm.
I beg your pardon.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely
yes.
Right, Senator. And then in that process, then it doesn't. These bills don't see any other committee, but are then moved straight to the House or Senate if it's a Senate bill. This is a House. This particular bill happens to be a House bill, and it'll be heard on the House floor, and it could be debated on the House floor. No amendments are allowed on the floors of the various of the chambers. And there are no there's no opportunity to modify once it comes out of the full committee. It goes to the two different chambers. If it passes this House bill, passes the House, and goes on to the Senate, it passes the Senate. It gets the signature of the Speaker of the House. It gets the signature of the President of the Senate. And then there's one other signature that's needed on it. Does anyone know whose signature who else would have to sign that bill? You got the House and
yes.
The Senate. And is Lee George on it? Is that what it is, Representative Johnson?
Governor.
Oh, it's the governor. Absolutely right. The executive, the chief executive for the state. And so even though we have one of the executive officers of the state with us today, the chief executive for the state, the governor, has to sign the bill to make it law. And that then appropriates those funds that Commissioner Roberts can use in the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So with that, would you like to take a break, or would you like to continue on, Director
yeah.
Roberts, or Commissioner Roberts?
Fine, whatever you want to
do.
Let's take a break. why don't we just take just about a 3 to 4 minute break, if we could, and that would give us an opportunity for you to go ahead about your visit to the Capitol. Welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.